This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, Why Jesus is Your Greatest Hope on Earth and in Eternity, by Phil Robertson. Available now, everywhere you get audiobooks.
Just let grace, speak truth, restart, this is the kingdom.
You're listening to the AND Campaign's Church Politics Podcast, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be progressive or conservative. We're trying to be faithful Christians in the public square.
This is the kingdom. The kingdom. The kingdom. Yes, it is. Gotta spread the word.
With your no good AND camp, you're listening to the AND Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney. That's me. And the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Chris, we talked about the Bears a couple weeks ago. You had imagined that they improved their offensive line. They really hadn't, but you had imagined that they had. But one good thing happened in week one. They did get a victory over the San Francisco 49ers. So we can celebrate that. Now, it's a little bit bittersweet for me. As I've said before, one of my high school friends growing up was Kyle Shanahan, who's the coach of the 49ers. So I wish it was at the expense of another team. But as a Bears fan, I will take a victory anywhere that I can get it, man. How you feeling about that victory, Chris?
Well, you know, I think the most important thing is that they did win. You know, and right now, there's only been one game. So we're having a perfect season. I'm very excited about the possibilities here.
It is a perfect season so far. So we'll hold on to that. My Commodores are 2-1. We took a L to Wake Forest. So I wasn't too excited about that. I had just bragged, and somebody mentioned it online. I had just bragged a whole bunch about the Florida Gators. They end up falling to Kentucky. It looks like when it comes to the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, that it's going to be a lot of beating up on each other. Georgia just jumped over Alabama to be number one in the nation. Just a lot of good teams. You got Arkansas coming up. I think you have Tennessee's about to play. Is it Tennessee and Florida about to play? There's just a lot of good games, man, going on in the SEC. You got the Big Ten, too, but nobody wants to talk about that. So on to other things. One of the things we want to do for y'all, and we've been talking about this for a while. We're going to be expanding some of our content. We wanted to not only have you listen to us, but we thought some of you might actually want to see us. And so our plan is to start putting these episodes on YouTube. We're also going to do what we said we were going to do and make sure for those of you who are Patreons, supporting us on Patreon.com, we're going to take, you know, some time after each episode to answer some of your questions, and that'll be for premium folks who are actually supporting us on Patreon. So we're going to start getting some of that stuff going. Hopefully y'all can view us on, for y'all that can listen and maybe want to watch, you'll be able to have that chance on YouTube moving forward. So we're trying to grow. We appreciate all your support. And as always, we want to give a shout out to our sponsor, the Fetzer Institute, for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. Also, shout out to all the people that give us small, large donations. We greatly appreciate that. We would not be able to do it without you. But Chris, as usual, we got a lot of good stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff that I think our audience is going to want to hear. So grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but to think like a Christian. All right, Chris, again, let me start with a little scripture. It says, at one time we lived in malice and envy, being hated and hating one another. That's my paraphrasing of Titus chapter 3, verse 3. Now, I'm going to be 100 with you, Chris. I don't know much at all. I don't know anything about the monarchy of the United Kingdom. For better or worse, I've never paid much attention to the crown, probably because I just never found it to be relevant to my life, never found it to be relevant to anything that I was doing. And so I just was kind of bored by it. I was never entertained by it. Now, I'll admit that I did try to watch the TV show The Crown. I think that's what it's called, based on the recommendation of a friend, but I don't even think I made it through one episode. I just wasn't intrigued, wasn't interested in what was going on. Now, that is not an implied criticism of those who are intrigued by the royal family. I have friends who are. It's not my cup of tea, but Chris, I surely have some peculiar interests that I'm sure some of our audience would find pretty boring. So, you know, this isn't a matter of me of any superiority on my part. That's just not the thing that I find to be interesting. Now, I do remember this, though, Chris. I do remember that people seem to have really liked Princess Diana. And I do remember her death and how tragic her death was and how the world responded. I can't even remember. I mean, that was years ago, but I do remember that. And then I've heard as of late that there's been some beef between the Queen and Prince Harry's wife. And some people think race is playing a role in it. I couldn't say if it is or it isn't. I'm not really following that closely. But that's as much as I really know about all this stuff that's going on. That's the extent of my understanding. So honestly, I'm pretty clueless about all this stuff. But by now, everybody knows, I'm sure, that Queen Elizabeth II died last week at the age of 99. She was the longest reigning monarch in Britain's history. So that is a big deal. People around the world have been mourning her death and just kind of remembering her legacy. And so that's been all over the media. And you'd have to be pretty much under a rock not to have encountered some of that. Now, of course, as is always the case, there's people who aren't mourning her death, and that's their right. And then you even have some people who aren't permitted to mourn her death based on their identity or based on the peer pressure that's coming from some people on social media. As always, in the gracious world and the charitable world of social media, people are getting dragged for offering condolences. Some people are going so far, Chris, as to say that offering these condolences is evidence of self-hate and brainwashing. If you let some folks tell it, if you want to be seen as authentic, you couldn't feel any kind of sympathy in relation to the passing of Queen Elizabeth. Not even for her children, not for her grandchildren. Those are just the rules that are set down by, I guess, the custodians of the culture, at least on social media. In other words, according to some social media influencers, who Chris might follow, but I don't really follow their prescriptions. According to these social media influencers, people of color were not supposed to mourn the death of the Queen on social media. People were getting called out left and right for expressing any level of grief for that death. That's just how it goes, I guess, on social media. Now, Chris, one of the awkward things that I found on social media is the moment when you see friends liking posts that you wouldn't expect them to like. Right. So sometimes that can really throw you off. You're like, man, I didn't think so-and-so would actually like a post like that. And I personally had some friends that I saw liking some posts, again, that I just didn't expect them to like. Posts that I found to be nasty. Some of them were mean. Some of them I found to be spiteful and demeaning surrounding this whole issue. And so I was surprised a few times by friends who were liking those posts or somehow promoting those posts on different social media platforms. Now, I don't have any condemnation for them, those friends. That's not really what this is about. I'm not even sure this is deep enough to even take it there, but it is something that I noticed, Chris, right? It didn't go unnoticed on my end. Now, I want to be clear, because this is, I think, somewhat of a complex issue. People shouldn't have to run away from the truth, though. And you know we stand on the truth when it comes to the Church Politics Podcast. No one should be expected to overlook Britain's wrongdoing throughout history. And I'm certainly not here to defend any of that wrongdoing whatsoever. The fact is, Britain has a long and deadly history of colonialism. Of colonialism in Africa, in the Caribbean, in Asia. And the effects of that colonialism are still being felt by many of those people. And that's serious business. That's not something we're going to joke around about or ignore. And the Queen is a significant part of that history. And many people have suffered mightily because of colonial greed, colonial supremacy and all kinds of exploitation. Those are just the facts. And this is no small matter. And it shouldn't be romanticized. In my opinion, Britain still has wrongs that it hasn't righted. It still has debts that it has failed to repay the victims of its colonial ambitions. And it still has demons that it has yet to face. Many of the riches that pay for the fine clothes and the palaces were ill-gotten if you want to look at the history of it. Much of that stuff was acquired through exploitation and theft. There's no other way to put it. And so calls for reparations have throughout history have been quashed, right? They advocates have been unjustly imprisoned, and some of them have even been killed. For example, and one of the examples that I would guess that many of you would know, is that you can't think about the horrors that South African leader Nelson Mandela experienced without including Britain's colonial legacy. From childhood, he is told in, before that he grew up in a system that tried to make his culture seem inferior to British culture. Mandela somehow avoided being completely indoctrinated by British culture, but it's something that he had to experience. He somehow kept in touch with his tribal upbringing, which is why he was so big on fighting against apartheid. But we know that South Africans for far too long suffered under apartheid, under British colonial government, and that should not and cannot be forgotten. So, with that history in mind, with that context in mind, how ought we as Christians deal with the Queen's death? Do we all need to deal with it the same way? Do we have to give a loud public condolence or some sort of resounding outcry for all to hear? I'm not sure that we do. Do we have to ignore the painful history and downplay the devastating impact of British colonialism? I personally think that would be a serious mistake, if not an injustice to do so, to approach it that way. But at the same time, Chris, I'll say this, and I'm about to pass it to you. Celebrating the death and making cruel jokes about the royal family seems inappropriate to me. Now, some of it may have been in good fun, I guess. I'll let you be the judge of that. I don't want to be legalistic about it. But I'll be honest with you. Some of the stuff I saw seemed hateful. Some of the commentary that I saw getting mad at people for showing some type of sympathy really seemed hateful. It seems like you were trying to draw people into your hatred, into your disdain, into your contempt. Now, at the beginning of this episode, I read Titus 3. And in Titus 3, Paul is describing, in that part of it, Paul is describing the difference between life as a pagan and life after receiving Christ. And this is what he said. At one time, we too were foolish, disobedient, deceived, and enslaved by all kinds of passions and pleasures. We lived in malice and envy, being hated and hating one another. But when the kindness and love of God, our Savior, appeared, he saved us. A lot of what I saw on social media being promoted by some Christians, again, seemed hateful, seemed to be filled with vitriol. And we know that a lot of truth can be said in jest, but also a lot of hatred can be said in jest. So whether it was a joke or not, it can express things that we probably shouldn't be promoting. Now, I think, and this is, I give a lot of deference to this example, Chris, I think Nelson Mandela had a much better approach than what I saw coming from a lot of people on social media. Because what a lot of folks don't know, and what I learned from reading in preparation for this episode, is that him and the Queen actually became friends. And that's according to his people, according to his memoirs and things of that nature. After living through apartheid, after 27 years in prison, away from his family, away from his community, on Robben Island, the human rights legend Nelson Mandela was able to treat the Queen respectfully and even be friendly. In his memoir, he wrote this, and some of you might want to cover your ears because it might not go along with your narrative. He wrote this: while I abhor the notion of British imperialism, I never rejected the trappings of British style and manners. It seems like, I could be wrong, Chris, and you may call me out on this. It seems like that we may be able to fight against injustice, hold people accountable, and be serious in doing that, because I don't know too many people who are more serious in doing that than Nelson Mandela, and not hate them after all. We might even be able to tenaciously reject parts of a certain culture while appreciating other parts of that same culture. Now, I know that's impossible on social media. Let y'all tell it. I know that's impossible in the culture war that we're all fighting right now. But we have to deal with the fact, whether you like it or not, that great minds and compassionate hearts in the past have accomplished that feat. And I will admit that it does take a larger degree of moral imagination than many of us seem to have today. And let's be honest, it's not like those bitter and caustic tweets bring justice to the people that were exploited by British colonialism. It's not like we're giving that a pass, right? But I do think, Chris, we have to think about, what do those antagonistic posts accomplish? What do we get out of those posts, right? Is this part of us being enslaved to all kinds of passions and pleasures? What pleasure do we get from tearing people down in that way, rather than just dealing with the history in a real way and trying to fix things? So, Chris, how ought we as Christians deal with the death of the Queen?
So I have to start by saying that I am one who is pretty into the British monarchy. You know, I pay attention to the monarchy, and you know, I watch The Crown, I watch The Queen, I watch The King's Speech. You know, I watched the Platinum Centennial last year when the Queen celebrated her 70th year of her reign. And so, you know, this is one of the things that I sort of, you know, privately pay attention to. I'm big on the kind of, I think what I like is pomp and ceremony, and the monarchy has plenty of that. I pastor a Assembly of God church. I'm always encouraging the AG to be more like the Church of God in Christ when it comes to you know, just like regalia and pomp and ceremony. So I'm into those things, and I should also say that since my congressional campaign, I've been on a very, very light social media diet, just because post-campaign, you know, trying to, you know, be cognizant of my own sort of like mental and emotional well-being. And social media is no place to, you know.
That's real, brother. Wise words, my man.
So I haven't seen, you know, in preparation for this podcast, I did go on and look at some stuff, but I was not getting that stuff in real time. But my wife will tell you, we were up in Wisconsin when the news of the Queen passing came across the wire. And I was walking around with my iPhone on CNN with my AirPods in, you know, because my wife doesn't care about the monarchy or the crown or anything like that, nor do my kids. But I was like, I wanted to, you know, be up on the coverage. So I'm into this thing, and I totally get where people are coming from when it comes to the very, very terrible history of British colonialism. But two things, and you know, if I come off as too much of a monarchy apologist, you know, refer to my opening salvo there.
As they say, speak your truth, brother.
But, you know, with this particular monarch, you do have to pay attention to the fact that she actually presided over much of the decolonization of, you know, of Britain. Didn't do enough, in my opinion, to pursue true reparation, to really own the unimaginable, impossible to really articulate or ever write kind of real, like, high class evil that British colonialism wrought all across the world, right? I don't think that this monarch went far enough on those things, but she did preside over decolonization. And she did, you know, develop a relationship with Nelson Mandela. She did, you know, several things to try to move this country in the right direction. And hopefully it continues to move more aggressively in that direction under the next monarch. So that's one thing. And then the second thing, and probably the most important thing, is what you were talking about. You know, you look at, you know, the British colonial empire in 1952 compared to 2022. That looks very different. Can you appreciate that and still, you know, hold Britain accountable, demand more from the crown and the British government more broadly? Can you look at this queen and see not only a monarch, but like a person who is, for whatever you think about the monarchy, these are still people, right? So this is still somebody's mother, somebody's grandmother, somebody's great-grandmother. Can you have any compassion for the people who do, you know, have some affection for the queen and for the crown, right? You know, do you just dismiss their whatever compassion they have? I would, you know, I think it would be going a little bit too far beyond, you know, sort of family and close friends to call it suffering. But any compassion and feelings that people are having, do you just dismiss that based on your sort of ideological framework? And do you actually have, as you so rightly described it, Justin, the moral imagination to at the same time look at a person's life, look at a nation's history, appreciate the things and celebrate the things that are valuable contributions, and still hold room in your heart for accountability and justice seeking in the places where that's necessary. And while it takes a lot to do that, and like social media and our broader context, that's really what we have to do with the life of every person, right? So as a pastor, I do way more than I would like to participate in funerals, oftentimes presiding over those funerals. Just did a funeral a week ago. And every time, you know, I get ready to prepare for a funeral, you find yourself going through the same exercise, right? Because every life has elements that are dark and that, you know, hurt people and cause real trouble and real pain. And every life has elements that are beautiful, that are good, that are worthy of celebration and honor. And one of the sort of careful things that you have to do in, you know, in pastoring people through loss and certainly in presiding over funerals is figure out how to celebrate those things that deserve celebration without sort of making light of those dark parts. And it's something that we all have to do. We all should be exercised in doing because all of us are going to go through some death. And I would just argue that the moment of a person's death, that season, those days and weeks in which people are actually mourning the time of a person's passing, to me, are not the right time to become very zealous for accountability and justice and talking about the stuff that was wrong. Now, if you are a person who were like in the fight for British colonial reparations for, you know, years and decades, and that's like your thing, then, you know, that's your thing. Do your thing. But like folks who weren't thinking about, you know, the negative impact of British colonialism, you know, a week ago, and when the queen passes, what it triggers in you first is like, you know, let's get mad. Let's talk about the bad. Let's demand justice. I don't gloss over those things, but I do urge us to take some moment of self-examination to say, why is that where my heart and my mind went at the moment of this woman's passing? So that's sort of where I am on it. You know, I'm in conversation with folks. We have a sister church in Cape Town, South Africa. So I'm looking forward to my next conversation with my my brother pastor over there in Cape Town, because I am curious about how this is being experienced in different parts of the world. But
Man. I mean, let me say this. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with British colonialism and the damage that it did. If you are one of those people, the internet's a beautiful thing. You can do some research, and really, I would recommend that you do some research and look at the impact that it's had on a lot of different places. Again, in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Asia, it's not a pretty thing. So do that research to have a better understanding where people are coming from, because it's real, man. And there may be ways that, you know, you can have influence or help some of the people that are still struggling with the impacts of that. But at the same time, a lot of folks are just bitter, man. We got to be very careful buying into this type of business, because as you said, you got folks who never talked about this before, but they want to drag somebody on the internet and say that they're brainwashed and that they have self-hate just for expressing some kind of sympathy towards certain people. We need to have the discernment to separate ourselves from that type of silliness. And that doesn't mean that you can't tell the truth and you can't speak on it when necessary. I'm all for that. But watch the bitterness. And then also realize, if you look at the way people act, she's a person. She was put in a situation where I think, and you said that she could have done more. At the same time, if we put ourselves in her shoes, a lot of folks I know aren't about to renounce their crown or any of the privileges that come with that crown either. So let's be honest and humble about what we would be willing to do in that particular situation. Does it justify it? Absolutely not. But it may bring a little bit of humility into the conversation and let us see it from a perspective that's a little more accurate, dealing with the depravity in our own hearts. And so I think those are some of the things that we have to deal with. Look, let's tell the truth. Let's always be truthful about history. We can't fix things if we're not willing to admit where the problem came from, where the root of that is, and who may be responsible for it. But at the same time, it's very easy to buy into the mindset, the tribal mindset, that we just need to attack anybody who doesn't share our narrative or isn't going along with the furtherance of our narrative. I'll let you take us out, Chris.
I won't explore this real much, but I will suggest that if you approach this only from that sort of like ideological bifurcated tribalism, you're going to run into a little bit of a sticky issue, because as you are like dragging folks for not only leaning into kind of like British colonial, you know, hatred or whatever, you'll run into the fact that the founding fathers of these United States, with which that same crowd find a lot of, difference and difficulty, it was British colonial power, right? That group that they came together to throw off. So, you know, history is complex and complicated. And one of the things that helps us move forward and try to build a better future is some capacity for reconciliation. And reconciliation sometimes, especially when you're looking at the depth of the problem, something like British colonialism, reconciliation can take a long, long time. But that's what it takes to move forward. So you might run into that trouble trying to sort out who's more evil, the founding fathers or British colonial power, or we could seek a path of reconciliation that allows us to hold people accountable, seek justice, but also appreciate that which is to be appreciated.
Very important. And I would just leave with this. If Nelson Mandela can find a way not to be hateful about it all after all he went through, why can't you? And what is your commentary about other people who show some sympathy? What is the implications that would have on his perspective? Something to think about. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney and the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Chris, I read a pretty interesting article the other day in The Atlantic by Derek Thompson. And I recommend everybody who's listening to us right now take the time to read this article. The article was entitled, America is a Rich Death Trap. That's right. America is a rich death trap. He starts off by saying, for citizens of a wealthy country, Americans of every age at every income level are unusually likely to die, from guns, drugs, cars, and disease. The National Center for Health Statistics recently released data showing that American life expectancy is falling, and it's not just because of the pandemic. Of course, we would expect due to the pandemic that life expectancy would be different. But even outside of that, even when we compare that to other countries, we still have a problem. Thompson says life expectancy is perhaps the most important statistic on the planet, synthesizing a country's scientific advances, policy errors, and social sins into a single number. And the U.S. fared worse in life expectancy than other high-income countries. Before the 1990s, an average life expectancy in the U.S. was not much different than it was in Germany or the United Kingdom. But according to data comparing U.S. and European mortality, American babies are more likely to die before they turn 5. American teens are more likely to die before they turn 20. And American adults are more likely to die before they turn 65. Europe has better life outcomes than the United States across the board for white and black people in high poverty areas and low poverty areas, says a Northwestern University economist. Now, again, this article points out things like gun deaths. It talks about obesity. It talks about our healthcare failures. It talks about cars. It talks about drugs and disease. And I think when we read this and look at it on the whole, Chris, this is embarrassing. And this is worse than embarrassing. It's deeply, deeply sad. Because what you and I know and what you and I talk about quite a bit is that we're not fixing a lot of these problems because we have a broken system. We're not even having good faith debates about a lot of these problems because we're talking about all kinds of other stuff. We're talking about Trump. We got to talk, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be talking about January 6th, but we got to talk about January 6th. We got to talk about all this other stuff instead of dealing with something that should be completely unacceptable in a country as prosperous as this country is. We have some very deep problems. Now, the answers that are given for these problems, I think some of them are good. I'm not with all of them. Right. You know, you got a lot of stuff. I mean, there's some good stuff talking about the environment, us driving cars and things of that nature, healthcare. That's cool. And even conversation about the gun debate. You know, I'm all about sensible measures when it comes to guns. But I don't think there was enough talk in this article about family. Right. And how the breakdowns in the family have an impact on this, about community. And how breakdowns in our community and us really just living in these lifestyle enclaves rather than really living in communities where we're communicating with people. We didn't talk enough about church and how, you know, people not being as religious as they were may have an impact on this. And it didn't talk enough to me about consumerism. So I think there's some impacts and some things going on in America not mentioned in this article that have a major impact on what's going on in addition to what's mentioned by Thompson in the article. Chris, what did you take from this article and what are generally are your thoughts?
Yeah, so when I read the article, the first time I was hoping that we wouldn't talk about this on the Church Politics podcast because I don't. So I think the identification of the problem is absolutely right. I 100% agree that it is it's shameful that we have this that our life expectancy is headed in the wrong direction, and that it is worse than all other wealthy nations in the world. That is a huge problem. It's a huge embarrassment. But I did not like the direction of the article much at all. Not that I 100% disagree with the solutions that I proposed, but if you say that life expectancy is the worst in the United States compared to all of the other wealthy nations of the world, and then immediately go to talking about, well, you know, the pandemic was worse here because the political right, you know, was putting out misinformation about vaccines and that kind of stuff. It talks a lot about, you know, it diagnoses this issue of cars, but pairs it in a strange way, in my view, to urbanization. And so when I got to that article, I'm like, so the solution to this is urbanization, healthcare expansion, and gun control. Yeah, I just don't think that's real, right? So, I mean, like, when you come to, like, vaccination, the political right was not the only vaccine hesitant group in the United States. Black people were probably the most vaccine hesitant. The article itself even points out that Native Americans and Alaskan Natives had the sharpest decline because those communities were also very hesitant about the vaccine. Because marginalized people in the United States don't have access to health care, have had a lot of reason over the years to be distrustful of the healthcare system. So that wasn't like a political right issue. That was a trust issue when it comes to healthcare, which goes back into the kind of thing that you were just talking about. What are we doing in our communities? Is that social fabric still there? And then you talk about guns and cars. I don't know that a lot of our car deaths have as much to do with the fact that we're in our cars more than other people. I think that pairs more closely with the drug and alcohol problem, right? It's not that we drive more. I mean, we may drive more, but it's probably a bigger problem that we drive high and drunk more than other people. And those alcohol issues and drug issues are going to go back into those issues about family, about community. We have a culture problem, right? Not to say that we don't have like a policy problem. I'm a proponent of healthcare expansion. I'm a proponent.
Well, can I stop you real quick? You do understand you can only say certain groups have a culture problem. You can't say everybody has a culture problem. Only certain groups are, you're only allowed to critique the culture of certain groups. So before you go too far.
Chris, I know. I was hoping when I first read it that you didn't choose this because I just thought that the article mostly got it wrong. That if we're going to talk about life expectancy in the United States, I think you got to start with a conversation about what has happened to our society and what has happened to our culture. Because while I am a fairly big proponent of a lot of what would amount to a progressive policy agenda, right? I'm for reasonable gun control. I'm for healthcare expansion. I'm for investing in affordable housing. I'm for all of those things. But it's not like we used to have fewer guns in America than the rest of the world. America has always been more guns than the rest of the world. America's always been more pro-freedom, individual liberty than the rest of the world. Those things are baked into the culture of the United States. The shift that we have seen is the falling apart of a lot of that sort of social and family dynamic. And I'm the first to admit that a lot of that happened in the process of people fighting against real injustice, where real people were suffering real oppression and injustice. But this is, again, where that I don't want to overuse the phrase in one podcast, but this is, again, where moral imagination has to come in. You got to be able to discern between systems and structures that are unjust and oppressive and need to be torn down and restructured. And those elements of our society and cultural life that are actually pillars and need to be passed along from generation to generation, and figure out how to renew and revive those types of institutions generation to generation, rather than just try to push through them and destroy them. And so, yeah, I read the article. I thought it got a lot wrong, enough wrong for me to come away from the article like, eh.
So I recommended that everybody read it. It sounds like Chris is saying, you don't have to throw away other better articles to read it. I would agree with you in this, Chris. I think Thompson jumped way too quickly after giving the facts. He jumped way too quickly into a progressive narrative and progressive agenda. So due to these facts, we must do this without really showing why we should do exactly what he's saying we should do. Okay, the urbanization thing, right? He's saying there's not enough housing in urban spaces, which forced everybody to move further away, which means they have to drive more. Is the answer really making our cities more dense?
And I will say, because I'm in Chicago, we're actually dealing with these. You know, I worked with Roosevelt University Hospital, and the fact is that the people who are living closer to the city center are actually much more unhealthy. If you look at life expectancy on a micro level here in the Chicago region, people in the suburbs who do commute are actually, their life expectancy is higher, right? So moving more people into the city is not necessarily a solution here. So
yeah. And I mean, that was a rhetorical question, but I do appreciate you answering it, sir, because I think it does bear answering.
I just want to put that claim for our listeners. Like,
no, I like that. I can dig it.
A solution. It's just not.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's run. I think it's oversubscribed. You have all these other places that are dying out, and we're forcing everybody into, 10 cities. That needs to be rethought. And so to say that we're dying because of that, that was a lot. He just, he jumped into a lot of stuff that I didn't necessarily make those connections. But I did want to point out when I brought this up, the lack of focus on family, these deaths of despair. Do the things that he names really stop these deaths of despair, which are drug overdoses, which are suicides, and the things that are really impacting certain demographics? I don't think you touch on that. And again, It jumps into things that can be polarizing, but aren't necessarily the right answers. What gets me about all of this is I know that we're not even spending enough time on a good faith debate on it. We got folks trying to bring Trump back into office. You know what I mean? We got all these things that's not going to help us move forward. That's not going to help us fix some of these problems we really need to address. And that's really what hurt me about seeing the numbers, seeing the data and getting that data put out there. I think he has some answers that make some sense. There are some things, as I said before, that I totally disagree with. I would have had a different focus in general. But my point is, we need to deal with it. We really need to process these numbers, and we need to deal with what's going on. Of course, I would hope y'all don't read an article or even an article that we recommend and think that means that's a full endorsement. But again, I still think it's worth reading, but I'll let Chris take us out of this segment.
Now, I absolutely think that it's worth reading because it lays out this problem, I think, really well in the front of the article. And it should give us pause, even reading the article, even if I think it serves more of a counterexample in terms of how we should be dealing with this this issue. You have to ask yourself, like, what in the world is going on if the United States of America is experiencing a decline in life expectancy? And we have a congressional commission on January 6th and no congressional commission on life expectancy.
Yep. And I'm going to point this out again. We have a party in the Republican Party, because we've been on progressives a little bit on this particular show, that has come up with no real plan for health care. That is, to me, political malpractice. They said they were going to come up with something because they had plenty of, issues with Obamacare, which was not perfect. But if you don't come up with something better and all you do is taking away, again, to me, that is malpractice when it comes to policy making.
you really want to see solutions there. And on the commission side, like, you have a party that has promised up to this point, if they take the House, then we're going to see investigations into the Justice Department and, you know, what was going on with the FBI and all those types of things. They haven't promised a commission on life expectancy. And so we have to figure out a way as, like rank and file citizens of the United States to begin to refocus our civic and public discourse. I might be naive on this point, but I still am a believer in the idea that an organized group of regular people can actually make a difference in the United States. So I'm still hopeful for that. But these are the types of things that we need to be bringing to the fore. And it's going to take us ignoring a lot of the distraction and the sideshow that has made its way onto the main stage, unfortunately, in our civics and politics.
And not just ignore it, disincentivizing the foolishness that goes on in Congress, disincentivizing people like Mitch McConnell coming along saying, hey, we're just trying to stop something. Do you know how much people are suffering and you just playing politics? I got an issue with that. But anyway, we will be back on the Church Politics Podcast. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. Again, it's Justin Gibney, the co-founder and president of the AND Campaign, and it's the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. So I know some of y'all have been following us for a while. And for those of you that have, you know that the AND Campaign did a lot of work addressing and educating people in regard to the Equality Act. The Equality Act was a piece of legislation promoted by the left, which would place sexual orientation and gender identity into the Civil Rights Act. This meant that Jewish, Muslim, and Christian organizations that didn't change their family and sexual ethics could be sued into non-existence. That's straight up one of the consequences, could have been one of the consequences of this passing. It meant that if this were to pass, and it was on high on Biden's agenda, it was passed through the House, but it didn't make it through the Senate, and we'll get to that. If this would have been passed, that would have meant that poor kids who attended faith-based schools would have had their federally funded free lunches taken away, that our young people who went to Christian colleges would have been ineligible for Pell Grants simply because people are upholding long lasting beliefs that, you know, humanity, many people in humanity have had for years and years and years. Right. It was very plainly bad legislation. And I think Chris would agree with me on that. The Equality Act unnecessarily pitted religious liberty against LGBTQ rights and created a false dichotomy that I don't necessarily think it had to. It just wasn't as thoughtful as it could have been. But the AND Campaign and our coalition of partners didn't just say no to the Equality Act. We did think it was important to say this needs to stop. This doesn't need to go any further. It doesn't need to be enacted. But we didn't just say no. We weren't just saying what we're against. What we tried to do was offer an alternative called the Fairness for All Act that protected the LGBTQ community from discrimination on the job, from discrimination in housing and banking, which to me was very important. I don't think anybody, any community in America should not be protected in those areas. But what it also did in the Fairness for All Act was not just have protection for the LGBTQ community, it also had protection for religious liberty. So we saw, and actually doing what democracy is supposed to do and thinking through something based on the Utah compromise between the LGBTQ community and Mormons in Utah, we came up with good legislation, thoughtful legislation. I think it was a model of civic pluralism that allowed, again, protection for our LGBTQ neighbors without tearing down religious institutions that disagree. These communities may always have disagreements, but that doesn't mean that we can't live in a way where we're protecting one another and protecting one and respecting one another's consciences. And that's what we've tried to do. So as of right now, the situation is that the Equality Act is not moving forward. It got through the House probably too quickly than it should have. I know for a fact personally that there were Christian legislators that voted for it that did not know the implications of what they voted for. And that's unfortunate. So it gets through the House. It does not get through the Senate. It doesn't look like it's moving forward in the Senate. So where we are right now is we're still fighting for the Fairness for All Act. And in the same vein, what's going on now is that Senator Baldwin and Senator Collins are pushing for the Respect for Marriage Act. And the Respect for Marriage Act would codify same-sex marriage into law, into federal law. According to Politico, Baldwin, along with a small group of Republican senators and Kirsten Sinema, they are working to secure enough GOP votes for the bill to break the legislative filibuster. So, you know, it's not just 50-50 in the Senate. You can filibuster, which means they would need to get 60 votes. Republican support is hinging on a bipartisan religious freedom amendment that aims to ensure the bill would not infringe upon 1993 religious freedom law. That religious freedom law was signed, that's RFRA, which was signed into law by Bill Clinton, a Democrat, okay? Baldwin says that senators are tweaking the amendment and continue to shop it around to the likely Republicans who would support the bill. They're expected to vote on this, Chris, on this Respect for Marriage Act sometime next week. So that's when we expect cloture on that issue. Now, I want to be very clear that the AND campaign stance on marriage has not changed. We are not promoting this particular law. Our focus has mainly been within the coalition to say, hey, how can we add the necessary language to this to make it so that it doesn't end up hurting religious liberty? And that's the conversation we've been having. But one of the things that I always want to point out about this issue, this LGBTQ rights and religious liberty, is how we can actually come to solutions when we stop and think. What happens too much, and you know this, Chris, is we hand, you know, once a coalition or a constituency wants something, really what happens is you hand the law to them, have them write it out. And if they're your supporters, you just push what they gave you. That's not a good way to go about democracy. This zero sum, all or nothing way of doing it. That's what the Equality Act represented. And I think the Fairness for All represented something very different for Christians who maintain their sexual ethic to say, no, that doesn't mean in any way that I want my neighbors in the LGBTQ community discriminated against. I'm not going to stand for that. It's not okay for one group to have the rights and another not to have it. And so that's what we've been trying to do. And we spent a lot of time, Chris, doing that. Anything you want to add just about this conversation?
Yeah, man, I think it's a very important conversation. It's one that I feel like I've been having more. But two things that I'll point out. One, this is what the Congress is supposed to do, right? One of the reasons why I think we have sort of that has forced the judicial branch of our federal government into very difficult spots that have frankly cost it some of its cachet and support, perhaps even legitimacy in the public discourse, is that the Congress has not been able to actually legislate and make laws, right? Like this, dealing with this issue of marriage is really not something that should be left to the courts. This is what the Congress is elected to do. So from that perspective, I'm glad to see that somebody in the Congress is having conversation about this. Second thing that I would point out is that, at least in my view, and you might, disagree with me on this. Other people who listen to the podcast might be disagree with me on this. But in my view, being uncompromising about your values does not translate into an unwillingness or an inability to reach legislative agreements. You have to, in the context of a legislature, I think, seek to protect the essentials, right? And I think you should seek to move the society as far in the direction of what you believe is right as is possible to do in the context of the legislature where you are working. But I don't think that being uncompromising on your values should translate into an inability or an unwillingness to reach legislative agreements. I think that you can reach a legislative agreement that does not fully embody your values without having compromised those values in real serious ways. And I think that that understanding that zero sum doesn't work on either side. It certainly doesn't work when, something like the Equality Act to me would represent folks who I disagree with taking a zero sum approach. But I don't think that the people who I agree with can in the legislature take a zero sum approach. And I think that that's something very important for us to wrestle with. Is one of the reasons that I really love the AND campaign is because we do have an uncompromising approach to our values. And inside of those values, we have a commitment to a civic pluralism. And I think that it's going to take that commitment and that level of moral imagination to make our government work. And so I'll just repeat it again, because maybe there might be somebody listening who participates in some way in some legislative environment. And I will say it one last time. I don't think that being uncompromising about your values means that you can't reach a legislative agreement.
And I would just add to that, you can love somebody and protect them and disagree with them on serious issues. Well, as always, guys, we appreciate y'all tuning in to the Church Politics Podcast. We got some changes coming and probably an announcement that we might make next week that I think y'all will be excited about. So as usual, Ann Camp, there's a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. I'll let you. Somebody say kingdom. Kingdom. Oh, Lord. I say kingdom.